everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
That's how it is, Dodger.
During the next half hour, Earth on the Air's grassroots tape contributors take us to Japan, where the last major untamed river in the country is about to be dammed.
And to the Pacific Northwest, where Snoqualmie Falls is a sacred site to Native Americans. But at night, a power company shuts the water off like a faucet.
Lou Gold talks about the interconnectedness between old forests, clear creeks, and salmon.
Ray Troll and Brad Mattson on ichthyosophy and why we shouldn't objectify fish.
An ode to the kitchen sink, and more.
First, a bus tour along the Tesha River at the base of the Ural Mountains in western Siberia. But it's not a pleasure trip for this multinational group of sightseers. Sponsored by the Physicians for Social Responsibility, these are the first civilians allowed to visit the plagued Mayak nuclear facility and to report back firsthand what radiation has done to the region.
Для того, чтобы контролировать состояние воды в реке Теча из радиоактивного загрязнения, был построен каскад.
This tour guide is explaining the radioactive condition of the waters surrounding Mayak. The tape was collected by Jane Fritz, one of the participants on the trip.
The bottom of the lake contains cesium and strontium, probably some plutonium and some of the longer-lived radioactive elements from the first cycle waste.
That's Ralph Patt, an Oregon-based geohydrologist who specializes in nuclear issues.
Their problems at the Mayak started in the year 1949 when their first reactor started up for the manufacture of plutonium to make atomic weapons, atomic bombs. And they dumped their wastes directly into the Tesha River. By 1952, these radioactivity started showing up in the Arctic Ocean. In order to stop the contamination or slow the contamination down, they built an artificial lake called Lake Karachay, and they dumped their first cycle waste into Lake Karachay. The contamination from the first 3 years was still in the Tesha River. In the 50s, they started to build a series of dams in the river in order to dam up, keep the sediments from moving downstream in the Tesha River. And the final reservoir is leaking some radioactivity out of the dam into the Tesha River. In 1957, one of their tanks blew up, exploded, and made a radioactive plume that extended about eight miles wide and about 100 miles long. And this contaminated area still contains a great deal of strontium-90. When we went out to the site of this plume, we stopped and we could see the signs along the road that said, contaminated area, don't walk in this area, don't drive your cars through the area.
What's it say?
It's dropping a little below 1,000 right now.
Mm-hmm. We're getting 745 here.
Under the bridge here. What'd you find?
It got close to 1,500 as I got closer, but not significantly higher than that.
No time for swimming, you had.
Good!
The Tesha River, they had to put up fencing along the river to keep the natives from using the water, and they forbid them to use the water. One of their problems is that downriver people are still using the contaminated river water. I think it's one of the greatest tragedies in the world that the people who lived along that river and were subjected to so much radiation in the early years and were never told about it, were moved around, and just an utter disregard for the health of the human individual for the sake of production.
So what kind of alternatives do they have? What do you see?
Well, certainly they've got to get that dam shored up. And in the Lake Karishai, what they're attempting to do is to fill that lake in. And that lake is so highly radioactive, if you stood alongside that lake for an hour, you would get a lethal dose of radiation and you'd die within probably a week to 2 weeks. What they're doing with that lake is putting concrete blocks in the lake and then dumping dirt in on top of that. And they're gradually filling that lake in. It's highly dangerous. The groundwater in the rainy season comes up into the lake, and the strontium 90 and the other radioactive elements move along in groundwater, and that's created a plume that's moved 2 kilometers.
So it doesn't look very optimistic for them in dealing with these waste issues.
Absolutely not. They have horrendous problems and very little money. And I'm sure there are many problems that we don't know about.
Music sent in by singer-songwriter Danielle Elder.
We can hear the creek that we're next to over here, and we're in a very unusual area on the planet in that we can reach down to this creek and drink the water right off the surface of the ground without any fear of contamination at all. And that's a very rare and unusual thing.
Lou Gold is sometimes known as the Hermit of Bald Mountain. He's a kind of modern-day Thoreau who lives in the Siskiyous of southern Oregon. French teacher Jean-Paul Bardou spoke with him at his home by a creek. Here, Gold describes what forest preservation has to do with our waterways.
You know, in an old-growth forest, if you look at the creeks, they're loaded with branches and twigs and needles and organic debris. Looks very different from the kind of creek you're likely to see in a city park. If the city park creek looks like that, the civic-minded people go out and they clean up the creek and they manicure it, maybe make nice designs along the banks, and so it all looks very beautiful when they're done. But when there's a heavy rain, the water will all be muddy. In these creeks, in the heaviest rain, the water is all running clear. All of that organic debris that's on the ground is a filter. It's like the original Mr. Coffee filter. It's straining the grounds out of the water. And the result is that the water in these creeks is the purest water running on the surface of the earth. That gives us drinking water. It not only gives us drinking water, but it creates habitat for the salmon. I showed you a little tiny creek earlier, and sometimes salmon 3 feet long will come up it, and it was only 2 feet wide, and they'll lay eggs in it. And the way the salmon does it is the female uses her tail, and she makes a little indentation in the gravel. She lays her eggs in it, does a mating dance with the male. He sprays sperm on the eggs. They're fertilized, and then she moves a little bit of the gravel over him to hold the eggs in place, but there's still room for water to get through that gravel. And everything goes well because the eggs get oxygen unless, If the forest was cut, you get erosion. Silt gets in the creeks, and the silt settles out in the low spots, and it plugs the spaces between the gravel, and the salmonates get suffocated. And the next thing you know, you don't have any salmon runs. And in Oregon right now, the scientists say that as many as 195 different salmon runs may be in serious jeopardy. And I think what we're saying is that nature is, in a sense, like a Humpty Dumpty problem. In other words, once you take it apart, there's no way to put it back together again. People say, what about loggers' jobs? But fishermen say, what about our jobs in the salmon industry? You see, it's not like preserving the forest destroys the economy. It's that you get one kind of economy out of extraction and exploitation. You get a different kind of economy out of preservation.
We're conduits for the fish.
Yeah.
The fish are calling.
But admitting you're obsessed with fish isn't easy, especially since there aren't any support groups or meetings you can go to, or therapists who specialize in fish addiction. Some of us are just different, I guess, but it seems like a lot of people are tumbling to fish life of one kind or another, losing control with our finny neighbors. It used to be that only the sports like fly fishermen took a bad rap for the single-mindedness that fish worship can bring. But now the club has widened to include artists, chefs, biologists, jewelers, writers, movie makers, radio announcers, interior decorators, comedians, and hucksters of every stripe. Any doubt that fish are the in critters is banished when you realize there are even dozens of magazines on just fish, how to catch them, how to cook them, how to keep them in tanks in your living room, how to sell them, how to understand them. Where will it end?
Ray Troll and Brad Mattson are addicted to fish. Troll is an Alaska-based painter. His fish portraits adorn T-shirts, lithographs, posters, and art galleries. Mattson is an editor for National Fisherman Journal. They have collaborated on a book of essays and paintings, Shocking Fish Tales. Behind their tongue-in-cheek portraits of fish is a profound respect for the creatures. Mattson and Troll talked with producer Steve Scheer.
One of the things that we discovered in the process of making this book was that it's real difficult for either one of us to objectify fish, to place them outside of ourselves, and in the sense that Western European culture objectifies prey. It's one of the conduits for abuse towards resources. If we think that the resources aren't part of us, and if we're hanging around water all the time and behaving towards the fish like we don't depend on them for our entire existence and for the health of the whole planet, we're making a terrible mistake. You talk to an Eskimo, and they don't sport fish, for instance, because the idea of hurting or tormenting something for fun is absurd when you consider that you're a part of it. You have to kill to eat, there's no doubt about it. But
fish are food, and fish are a big part of the culture. And they are one of the few creatures I've ever killed in my life, and I actually have found that a lot of commercial fishermen and sports fishermen, when they've killed them, they go through, it's a rough thing, it's a tough thing to do. I found a lot of commercial fishermen actually do have nightmares. I did some of this artwork here. I have a picture of myself laying in bed with a salmon hovering above the bed, like, why did you do this to me? And just the thing that I've written across the bottom says, sometimes late at night, the spirits of all the fish I've ever killed come back to haunt me. And when I did that, I've had hundreds of people actually come up to me and say, I know what you're talking about there. I've had those dreams, or I feel that way.
People always want to say, well, do you think fish feel it? Well, that's not the point. The point really is that you can't objectify anything. We're all part of the same show here, and for one thing, fish feel things in an entirely different way than we do. They have what's called a lateral line, which is the original good vibes detector. You know, whether or not they feel exactly like we do is not the point. The point is that we are diminished when we objectify our prey.
That's what Brad and I are doing, too, is we're kind of conduits for commercial fishermen and for ichthyologists, just to kind of spread the news on how fish be cool.
You talk about the spiritual implications and the fish cults and like that. Well, they're much more practical critters than that. After the Ice Age, fish salmon renitrogenated the soil. That's probably was their main job. They went out to sea, brought nutrients back, and started the soil building process.
It's fairly common knowledge that fish need trees. Now you don't really along logging streams and all that. But do the trees need the fish? You know, what are the fish ever done for the trees? Well, they actually do.
They built the soil so the trees could grow.
That's fascinating.
They built the soil.
And the critters that are eating the fish too are also out there wandering around and defecating.
The only way you can unlink all of this is to objectify any part of it and to say that you are going to subscribe to the 2,000-year-old fallacy that this whole show is set up for us. As soon as you get over that, everything gets better. And as soon as our culture gets over it, things are going to start getting better.
Heavy message, man.
Heavy message.
Ray Troll and Brad Mattson's book, Shocking Fish Tales, was published by Alaska Northwest Books in 1991.
On its way to western Washington's Puget Sound, the Snoqualmie River gets a crashing ride down the 200-foot drop of Snoqualmie Falls, except at night when the water is turned off by the regional power company. This tape was contributed by Kelvin Kleinman, a Seattle drum maker. He spoke first with Snoqualmie tribal member Andy De Los Angeles.
One of the things that we're fighting for here is you know, our religious right to a holy place such as Snoqualmie Falls. I might get into one of the creation legends about Snoqualmie Falls. The Transformer, or the Great Spirit, or however you want to put terms to that, came to this land and found that one part of the tribe was becoming really greedy about the salmon and fish that was returning. So what the Transformer did was drop a huge rock from way up in the sky, and it fell to the earth and made a big hole in the ground and stopped the salmon from going up to the upper Snoqualmie tribe. Consequently, the place became a religious site in that people would come down here and pay homage, either through walking underneath the falls, swimming in the pool, diving from the top of the falls, because if you survive the dive, you come up with one of the most powerful water spirits in the Pacific Northwest for healing and war. And the tribe has been coming to this place since the creation legend and paying the homage here.
Snoqualmie Falls is not holy only to the Snoqualmies. Members of tribes from around the country visit the site during periodic spirit gatherings to show solidarity for the integrity of the falls.
About 100 years ago, a power plant was built on this site, and it's still here. At the time, it was a marvel of technology. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. That marked the beginning of an era when the falls became something else than a falls. They became more of a faucet. Most people don't know that right now, what you see is not a real waterfall. It's a controlled water flow, 220 days a year. You can look at the flow now and you can see that more is coming out at the bottom of the falls than at the top of the falls. So this is sort of a philosophy 101 question is, when is a falls not a falls?
We do have an aesthetic specialist who evaluates the aesthetics of a natural feature as opposed to a building or a highway.
Puget Power and Light's spokesperson, Virginia Pistorisi.
And in evaluating this, they look at a whole variety of criteria, the plume, the mist, the width of the falls, how it plunges, how it moves into different areas of the rock edge, if it spreads out at a certain point, and they look for thresholds of aesthetic values. It's actually a very amazingly complex science.
Certainly having the falls shut off is an English word to fit that would be sacrilegious. you know, if this is the way you people think about religious sites, well, then let me go to Bethlehem, or let me go to Jerusalem and dig up some of the stones where, you know, where you call your Jesus walking the ground here. And don't get me wrong, it, that Jesus and the Great Spirit are one, but how you people have come to this country and destroyed, you know, in essence, a lot of the holy sites for us and most of the people of the native people of this land, that there's no respect. There are not very many of us, Snoqualmie people. I think that this country and these and all of you folks out there should give us the dignity and respect as we try to hang on to some of the things as we're going out.
The U.S. Department of Energy will decide whether to renew Puget Power & Light's lease on Snoqualmie Falls in December of 1993.
The river was born naked, shimmering and gurgling, this Hokkaido poet recites. Songs and spheres of light, these are its beginnings. His poem is about the Nagara River, the last major river in Japan without a dam. But a dam is being built at the mouth of the Nagara, and it's close to completion. Producer Guy Nelson, visiting Hokkaido, found that the damming of the Nagara has mobilized a grassroots environmental movement in unprecedented numbers. A government-sponsored video display near the dam construction site gives details of the dam's dimensions and how it will operate. A young woman on the video is dutifully captivated. She illustrates a traditional Japanese reaction to authority. Don't question it. But that's changing. Knowledge of political corruption in Japan has become commonplace among its citizens. Now, with government projects like the Nagara River Dam, people are learning to doubt bureaucratic motives. Mayumi Omori is the head of the local opposition at the dam site.
The opposition to the dam has snowballed as more and more people have come to understand the problems associated with it. There are about 3,000 rivers in Japan. Most already have several dams, and almost all the trout have been killed off from these rivers.
Omori is worried that the dam will cause dangerous flooding of the nearby town of Nagashima. She also says livelihoods that depend on estuary creatures will be destroyed. This Nagara River clam fisherman agrees.
I've fished for 30 years, since I was 15. If the dam is built, my business will be finished. The clams need water that is a bit salty, so they will die when the dam separates the salt from the fresh water.
A local spokesman for the dam project, Fujimoto Yashimura, says that by cutting off the salt water into the Nagara, crops will be saved upriver. Also, he says, the dam, by providing flood control, will help save, not endanger lives, and by creating a huge surplus in the local water supply, development in the area will be encouraged. Reiko Amano is a well-known nature writer and activist in Japan. She says the government is lying about its reasons for going ahead with the unpopular project.
Our government have secret money. I think why our government stopped this dam, they have big secret money.
Amano has written a book called This is Japan, which delves into Japanese pork barrel politics. Developers are getting rich with government contracts, says Amano,
while officials are getting rich off bribes. And that's the reason for the Nagara River Dam. It's a charge that riles Minister of Construction spokesman Gutara Takamura.
It's not fact. It is not correct. This project plan for the human lives of this river basin, not we politicians, always thinking about the safety against the flood control. The protests say, so that is, it's a lie, I think so.
The Nagara River Dam is scheduled to be completed by the end of 1993.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground. And the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.
The river is free. This music was contributed by singer-songwriter Dana Lyons.
It wasn't that long ago when, if you wanted water, you had to go out to a well or down to the river and then bring it back to your house. These days, all you have to do is just turn the faucet and out comes water, transported from pipes, from reservoirs, wells, miles away, water in seemingly unlimited amounts. I'm Lowell Dellalba, and this is The Kitchen Sink, Part 1. The water hums out of the faucet as we wash the dishes and pots. We scrape the forks and spoons, which make jingling noises as the water hums. Part 2. Oh, sink, you have such power. At the turn of a knob, your faucet releases the source of life on our planet. Water, fluid, sustenance for trees, frogs, gorillas, flowers, bees, anteaters, and men and women. Sink, you are like a god. Your faucet is there always to open a stubborn bottle cap with a hot thrust of water. You put life into instant coffee, tea, frozen orange juice, powdered milk, and even oatmeal. Oh, sink, without you, our refrigerator and stove would be lonely.
If you'd like information about any of the pieces you heard on this program,
or if you'd like to find out about contributing your tape to Earth on the Air,
write to us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Earth on the Air is produced by Peter Maloff and Suzanne Tedesco. Our engineer is Eric Bowerman.
Additional production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation, and listener members like you.
And special thanks to KUOW in Seattle, the Dubtrain Cassette Duplicating Services, and all the Earth on the Air volunteers and staff.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you're interested in show number 30. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Peter Maloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.